I'm David Zellner.
And I'm Nathan Zellner.
We are the filmmakers of Kimiko the Treasure Hunter, and you're listening to Filmwax Radio.
Hey everybody, Adam Shartoff here, host of Filmwax Radio. How's the Kickstarter doing? It's doing fair to middling. We're doing well, but if you can hear my voice, if you're a fan of the show, if you like anything about the show, go over. I can just tell you right now, this show is going to blow up. We're going to have amazing, I'm going to have room for everybody. We're going to have help with getting the show produced. It'll be fantastic. I can hire somebody to help me out. I can get a head start, and we're going to do a whole outreach campaign to get sponsors for the show, just a few, so we can afford to, you know, on an ongoing basis, to do a high-quality show. That's really what we're talking about. And in a way, affect the film industry, the independent film industry, which I do in my own little way, but I want to do it in a somewhat larger capacity. So that's where your dollars, where your support, where your sharing of this campaign is going. Go to Kickstarter right now, please, friends. Go to Kickstarter.com, and there's a search bar right at the top. Type in Filmwax, F-I-L-M-W-A-X, and you'll see there's my campaign will come up, Filmwax Radio 2.0. And you can pledge, and you can check out the rewards. I may update the rewards a little bit going into the final week of the campaign. We're trying to raise $30,000. That's a lot of money. But trust me, it's going to go into a studio. It's going to go into hired help. We're going to get a head start. So in about 6 months, 8 months from now, we will be able to hopefully have a bunch of sponsors and other means of keeping the show going, keeping the lights on here at Filmwax HQ. So thank you very much. Sorry to keep advertising myself, but it's an important thing. Today's show is jam-packed with fun and excitement. We have three films that are in various stages of undress. That's not what I meant to say. They're out currently. Like, there's two films you can see right now, and a third one coming out Friday. First of all, we're going to have Sonia Sohn, who many fans of The Wire, HBO series The Wire. She's going to be on the show. She's directed a documentary called Baltimore Rising, which you can this very instant. But I'm not going to tell you to go right now, but you could watch the movie first and then listen to this conversation with her and one of the subjects from the film, one of the people in the film named Kwame Rose. And he's on the, and we did that, and everybody got on the line and did that. And that's currently, again, on, if you're a subscriber to HBO or if your parents are, you can watch it. But see it. It's a great film about the aftermath, the death of Freddie Gray. I'll tell you a little bit more about it right before, later on when we're getting into it. But we're going to be joined again by Sonia Sohn and Kwame Rose for Baltimore Rising. We also have the lovely Noelle Wells, a young actress. I'm sure you've seen her. She's been on Master of None, on Saturday Night Live, the Jessica James indie film. She's just been all over the place. You will recognize her. And she's making her directorial debut on Friday, releasing a film called, a comedy called Mr. Roosevelt. And we'll get to that also in a little bit. But first, these guys that are coming up first, their names are Josh Corey and Miles Kane. They have a documentary called Voyeur. And it's going to be on Netflix on Friday, December 1st. But it will also be playing theatrically at the IFC Center in New York City and at the Lemley Monica Film Center in Los Angeles. So if you're in New York or L.A., you have a chance to go check it out, which I recommend you do. In New York, I know that Josh and Miles will be at the IFC Center this weekend for Q&As. And you never know, maybe one of the people that's in the film, who is Gay Talese, the famous author and journalist, he very well may show up. He was at the screening I went to at the New York Film Festival a couple of months ago. So he's definitely supporting the film. Okay, well, let's get into that, actually, since these guys are up first. I think that would be a good idea. Voyeur follows Gay Talese, who is now 84 years young. He's still very, very sharp and energetic and all these things that you call somebody when they're getting old. You know, it's just terrible. Anyway, but, you know, he's one of the giants of modern journalism. He was one of the founders or one of the pioneers of new journalism, as they used to call it, along with, you know, Tom Wolfe and Norman Mailer and of those guys in the 60s. and 70s. So we followed Talese as he reports on one of the most controversial stories of his career, a portrait of a Colorado motel owner named Gerald Foos, who's also in this film. He's very in the current day, that is. For decades, Foos secretly watched his guests with the aid of specially designed ceiling vents, peering down for an observation platform he built in the motel's attic. He kept a detailed journals of his guests' most private moments, from the mundane to the shocking. But most of all, he sought out, spied on, and documented one thing: strangers having sex. Talese's insatiable curiosity leads him to turn his gaze to a man accustomed to being the watcher, exploring a tangle of ethical questions. What does a journalist owe to his subjects? How can a reporter trust a source who has made a career of deception? Who is really the voyeur? So let's go into it right now, everybody. This is Josh Curry and Miles Kane with Voyeur.
I received this letter in 1980 from a man named Gerald Foos, who decided he wanted to buy a motel for the express purpose of using it to watch everything that was being done in private.
It had a high-pitched roof. That's where I would build my observation platform. They couldn't hear me. They couldn't see me. It was exactly what I wanted.
I'm writing a story about him for The New Yorker. I'm a natural person to write about a voyeur because as a writer, I'm a voyeur myself.
Nobody ever will be able to do what I did.
I mean, Foos is really disturbed, a sociopath who just needed the attention.
I spent more than 25 years waiting to bring his story and him as a person into the public eye.
Well, interestingly, even before the New York Film Festival, where Josh, I think, all of us met, actually, right, Josh and mm-hmm. Miles, was the Vermont College of Fine Arts, which I'm plugging, because they've been very nice to me, and they've sponsored the show over time and the film program there. Yeah. And that's one of your gigs, right, is your on the faculty?
No, I was actually a student there. I needed to get. Yeah, I was.
Oh wait,
was,
you had a student film.
Yeah, well, this was. I mean, I teach as well. I teach at Pratt and FIT.
Oh, you're up that way.
I needed to get my. I needed an MFA because academia requires that.
Right.
But Vermont was terrific,
and you could do it from Brooklyn.
We could do it. It's low residency. You could do it from Brooklyn, and right. You know, I knew about a lot of the faculty there already. Some of the people I worked with, Lisa Lehman, Nina Davenport. These are all great filmmakers, mm-hmm. filmmakers that I respect.
Right.
Jake Mahaffey, and one of my faculty advisors was also an old friend, Jeremiah Zagar. Mm-hmm. When he saw the film and when he saw the 15-minute cut that we had made, loved it, and he wanted to come on board as an executive producer.
Oh, you had a 15-minute cut of the
at the
of
time. Lawyer? This was like mid. This was a couple of years ago, midway through the program.
Okay,
and then after it finished, mm-hmm. we all met with Public Record, who is one of our executive Jeremiah Yakas.
Public Record, what's that?
They're a production company, but
okay.
Jeremiah Zagar does all of his work is great. You should check out their website.
I will.
But anyway, they introduced us to Impact Partners.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
And it was the beginning of everything, and
Dan
it really
and
helped.
And all those guys.
Yeah, and everybody was amazing. I mean, our group, all the way down through Netflix. I mean, everybody creatively was amazing to work with and mm-hmm. was really, really supportive of the film.
Normally, I do this, this is kind of backwards, but since we're talking about it, the timeline, where did you have your world premiere for Voyeur?
So we world premiered this past September at the New York Film Festival.
Oh, so that was the world premiere.
That was the world
okay,
premiere.
Okay, I couldn't remember. Then I remember the next day we were like in the Hamptons, and it was there as well. So that was your Long Island premiere.
That was our Long Island premiere, yeah.
Got it.
Hamptons was fun, though. It was a good festival.
Yeah. But didn't you used to program there?
I used to program there. It's changed a lot. It's great. I mean, uh-huh. it was always prominent, but it's sure. the all the screenings were packed. I mean, maybe people were just interested because it was, you know, good slots and the maybe they're fans of Gates Lease, but mm-hmm. They were awesome screenings.
Voyeurs.
Yeah.
Well, the first voice that we've been listening to is Josh Curry, who's half of the directing team behind a new documentary called Voyeur.
Hogging the mic.
Hogging the mic, co-opting the mic. And that other more genteel voice is that of Miles Kane, who's the other half. Let's just say right from the top that people have already heard I'll play a little audio clip or something at the top. So that it's going to be on Netflix on December 1st, which is this Friday, coming up in just a couple of days. But normally, as I said to you guys, and I'm telling the audience, anybody listening, I would normally post this show because the majority of people are probably not in New York City, but a lot of them are. So normally I would post it on after so people go directly over to Netflix and listen. But I also wanted to mention that also there's a theatrical coming up in a couple of days in New York and also in
L.A.
as well, both on the 1st of December as well.
Yep, same launch date.
Okay, so that's why I'm posting this on Tuesday in late November. Right. So again, it's called Voyeur, and it stars two men. I'm going to turn over. I'm talking too much. So normally I would do a little bit of the synopsis, but other voices need to be heard here.
I always
Miles, why don't you?
I always like hearing people's take.
I can do it and then jump in.
Just give a quick.
Okay. It's a musical comedy about.
This is a new one.
Yeah. I hide in crawl spaces. I look at shocked faces. Please stop.
It writes itself.
Or maybe not shocked. Maybe they're more just excited. They're okay. So this guy bought a motel back in the early 70s. When was it? When did
or late 60s?
Foos, Gerald Foos, right? Was his name?
Gerald
Foos. Foos. And he bought this motel, and he built, when he was constructing it, he built a crawl space, a hidden crawl space above all the rooms, and so he was able to voyeuristically look at people having sex. It was his, he wanted to, and then there's this other justification, in a way, if you want to call it a justification, or his rationale was that he was kind of sociologically making notes, sociological observations, right, about people's behavior, sexual behavior in particular, right?
Right.
And then
he fancied himself a researcher, which we made.
Anytime you say you fancied, you know that this guy's bullshit. But
Susan Morrison says right off the bat, we just had this discussion a little earlier. She, the New Yorker editor, and she says, you know, this guy's a sociopath. And we wanted to just sort of make that clear to the viewers that we're not drinking the Kool-Aid here, that this is what Gerald thinks of himself.
Right.
But that's not necessarily what us, the filmmakers, or what the audience necessarily should feel about.
Although she does go on to make the point, which is, I think, what we also believe, mm-hmm, that this guy is a bit of a sociopath. But the fact that he actually did this, and not only did this, but obsessively, and he didn't record this, which is, people always ask us. That's the first thing people ask us is, did he film it? And when we say no, they look disappointed. But he recorded it meticulously in written word, you know, hundreds of journal pages.
Sure. Dated. And these people are anonymous, right, in his notes. So
they're anonymous in the book. Mm-hmm. I think he did. Maybe he used last initials for last names. But it's incredibly detailed. I mean, date, time, race, gender, mm-hmm, description of height, weight, and then obviously sex, but also not sex. He would record, you know, other strange behaviors, boredom, you know, mm-hmm, was a fascinating thing that Gay talks about a bit. And we sort of represent in the film is voyeurism is 90% anticipation.
Oof.
You know, it's a lot of real and
waiting around.
And even when you get the quote unquote good stuff, real life is not, it's not a porno, as Gay says in the film, you know, it's sex. Even real life sex is not exactly maybe what your mind's eye wants to conjure up. You know, it's and it's more about the danger and the excitement of waiting and then watching. But it's not even so much about what you end up seeing, I don't think.
Interesting.
So, it's a fascinating story. And I guess we haven't described in the synopsis that part two of this is that this Gerald Foos, this voyeur, wrote a letter to his favorite journalist in 1980, Gay Talese, who was kind of a legendary nonfiction writer, a part of the new journalism movement with Truman Capote and Norman Mailer.
And he was at the Plimpton. Top of his game.
He was at the top of his game. He was at the height of controversy. He had just finished a 10-year book called Thy Neighbor's Wife, right. Which was all about kind of the changing sexual lives of Americans. And this was everything from a slight biography of Hugh Hefner to gay managed massage parlors. And then most famously and controversially, he kind of lived at this sex commune for swingers in California for months on end, and conducted research, aka involved himself intimately.
So even though he may not have been hidden, there is a common thread that these two guys share.
The theme of voyeurism, for sure, is something I think gay even relates to.
Well, these are also remarkably similar characters. I mean, at first glance, they couldn't be any different. But when you dig a little deeper, you realize that, yes, they're both voyeurs as gay states. And and you realize when watching the film. But also, they also have these meticulously documented and private lives. And if Gay's bunker is incredibly detailed, he saves everything. Gerald Foos has his own collection, the sports card memorabilia collection, guns, and, you know,
posts. And his journals, his notes.
And his journals, of course. So these are, and they both have big egos, and they both, feel like they want to understandably control the story or the legacy, their legacies. So, you know, even though they're very, very different people, they share a lot of the same
characteristics in a way. I mean,
yeah.
And how old, Gay Talese around 84 during the production, correct?
Yeah.
And
then, I think it's 81 to 85. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. And Gerald, how old is
Gerald is a few years younger than Gay, so he's probably about 83 now.
Birthday cake says 83 at the end of the movie, so.
Oh, yeah, right.
He was about 79 I think we first met him.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So they're both getting on. I mean, they're both kind of reconciling a lot about their lives at this stage, potentially.
Well, that's what was interesting is, I mean, we wanted to make a real-time story about a journalist and a subject and about the act of nonfiction journalism and as a result, documentary, referring to ourselves. But what was also interesting is it wasn't just a reporter writing about us. It happened to be this legendary reporter kind of near the end of his career, writing about a guy who's at the end of his life. And both of them, as Josh said, obsessed with sort of how do we both control and sort of write both our legacies in different ways. You know, Gay was interested in is thinking about how he'll be remembered as a journalist. And obviously, Gerald had these delusions of grandeur of thinking, maybe Gay Talese can sort of legitimize me and I can be thought of of this great sort of...
Or normalize, as we see now, right?
Normalize.
Yeah, yeah. So Gerald writes to Gay, and Gay...
In 1980.
And then for years and years, they had this kind of relationship in terms of correspondence and whatnot, and Gay is collecting details for a book, which eventually gets written, but takes decades, right? It's taken decades, and it's called The Voyeur's Motel
by Gay Talese, and there was also an excerpt in the New Yorker,
which stirred up a lot of
big news piece and got a lot but no, and just to clarify, the reason it took 30 years wasn't because Gay did 30 years of research. It was that it's important to say that Gay Talese went out after receiving basically a fan letter from this voyeur, kind of teasing him with this, seducing him with this story. Gay Talese, being the ever curious journalist, flew out to Denver based on this one letter, met this guy at the airport, spent the kind of lost weekend with this guy at his motel, spying with him.
It's in Colorado.
Colorado. Mm-hmm. It's now been demolished.
Sure.
Spoiler alert. But
yeah, don't go looking for it if you're in that part of...
There's plenty of other motels to stay at.
Yeah.
but Gay spied with him and was, of course, fascinated. And Gerald wanted him to write a book. But the sticking point was that Gerald wanted it to be this anonymous book about a voyeur in a motel in an unnamed location. Mm-hmm. And Gay said, you know, that's a deal breaker for me. I use real names, real facts. And so they both sort of just have been at a standstill for the last 30 years. And Gay finally Gerald sold his motel in the early 90s. Mm-hmm. So Gay came back to him, you know, 4 years ago now and said, how about now? Neither of us are going to be around much longer. It might be time.
Right. In other words, still.
But real names. I'm going to use your name. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Do you want to finally step out into the light?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And, well, you have to watch the documentary, of course, to know how things go and all that. But there was a, I don't know how much you want to give away, but there were some facts, which, a couple of facts that were kind of central to the timeline of when the hotel was sold, that it was not clear. And then, so, which the book had already been published, like literally just published. And so, and then all of a sudden Gay, who prides himself, of course, of being of the utmost ethically, journalistically detail oriented and factual. And all of a sudden has to feels he must disavow the work he just I'm sure the publishers just love that morning at the office. But then, interestingly enough, the same information ended up actually verifying because when things were cleared up, it turned out that that same information actually verified certain the facts of the timeline even more so, as it turns out, right?
I mean,
it was a very dramatic.
Yeah, and not to reveal too much in the film, but it's, you know, the specter of inaccuracies is always kind of looming around the corner. And,
sure.
And Gerald is, to a degree, an unreliable narrator. And as Gay says in the film, you know, he's my single source and you're unwise to have one source,
right.
Which is, I think, something that Gay understands and we understood when filming this. But, you know, it was a seductive story. It was something that Gay had been wanting to make for 30 years. And we were on this ride as well. And we all, you know, bought into this idea of this character and just letting him tell the story and us documenting it. So, but it's all in the film. And at the end of the day, the film is about all these twists and turns, but it's also about the subject artist relationship and the complications that come along with that.
Yeah.
And to a degree ourselves as well, you know, we're documentarians, we're there, we're present.
In your viewing.
We're affecting things.
Right. Yeah.
There's two documenters and there's two subjects in this movie. Gay plays both roles and you see him struggle with that and sort of try to navigate that being both journalist and subject at the same time. And it definitely is a recipe for some conflict in the movie. So,
yeah. How is he? We mentioned he's 84. He's part of the New Journalism group of writers back in late 60s, maybe?
Yeah, 60s, 70s, yeah.
Yeah. He left off. Tom Wolfe was in there.
Yeah,
too, right?
Tom Wolfe.
Maybe the most famously, right? No, Gay Talese, most famously. Can't say that. He may be listening. But he's 84. He seems in great state, great health, great mind, and sound mind. I mean, completely, right?
Well, that was what was inspiring to us when we first started was this idea of here's a guy who is... had a full legendary career, is worthy of a biopic for sure. It's not the sort of films we're interested in making. And what we were excited about was that we realized we were at this point in time where we had an opportunity to make a real time biopic, you know, in a sense, being that we would watch an unfolding real time narrative of this journalist at work, and not just any journalist, but a one who's, technically, you would expect to be past his prime and sort of, you know, looking back at his career. But here's this guy who's still fully curious and wanting to be active. And again, talking about the significance of this story, this was a story from 30 years ago that he almost was trying to tie up. It was one that got away and he thought, let me try to pull it back, you know.
Yeah.
And that's what a lot of the movie is you see him struggling with the story he fell in love with that he was seduced by 30 years ago, and seeing that conflicting with the kind of the harsh light of day of 30 years past and new facts and things not being verified. And you really see it's probably one of the most challenging stories he's written in a way. And you see him struggling with that.
Yeah.
Which I think just to make the point about the biopic is arguably a more fascinating and maybe more truthful portrait of someone than telling a story, a history piece about someone's back, you know,
isn't
past.
It's more interesting to get into the very.
It's not as flattering.
Fiber.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, sure. I think so. I think he comes off great, actually, because you see him flawed, too, which is, you know, I think that's a good thing.
It's human, and it
humanizes him. Because he seems like he's so careful and cautious about how he presents himself. So obviously, you can see he's a bit of a dandy, and then he's married to a very famous publisher. But he has a very great, beautiful life and beautiful lifestyle. You know, where's the cracks in the veneer? Where is that? And the film does show it. Because you're able to, I think what separates it from a biopic or biodoc is that you do get to the essence of this guy with with this story and with the challenges he runs into, the anxiety it causes him, you're getting right into the very essence of the guy, which is far more interesting than just going through the chapters. You know?
Yeah, I mean, it's a warts and all documentary, although there are no real heroes in this film. There's a lot of gray characters, which for us is true to life. We try to make character-driven documentaries. It's always the most important thing for us, the kind of work we do. But it's what excited us about this project. Even the voyeur, I mean, I'm not suggesting that the voyeur is a likable character, but you see, hopefully, when watching this, there's a little bit of, you know, I have a little sympathy for him.
I have a great deal. I mean, as a viewer, I didn't live with him for, you know, off and on for years like you guys did. But from you were there very close for a long period of time. But when I went to the New York Film Festival screening, one of the public screenings, actually, I got to meet Gay Talese. He was there. He was at your Q&As. He seemed to really be very, very involved. Obviously, he was really, just participating a great deal in the Q&A. And so, obviously, he's supporting you guys. And he went to a couple of other festivals with you? Just that one?
I think that one, but he's been to every screening in New York City, and he does support the film. I mean, look, it's really important for us to show.
He's coming to the IFC Center?
I don't know if he is.
I'm not sure if he is. Yeah.
I wouldn't be surprised to see him there.
Oh, you mean you haven't arranged it?
We haven't arranged it.
Don't you think the audiences are probably some people would be hoping and expecting him?
We'll see.
Yeah, we'll see.
it'll be a surprise for everyone. But yeah, it was tough. You know, I mean, look,
John Vanko is probably hoping he could publish that on the website.
Yeah, well, we'll be there.
That's true, and that's worth the price of admission for me.
But as documentarians, it's important to show. I mean, we know some people who don't show their subjects, which seems crazy to me. But I mean, I think it's common for people to show, you know, the subjects, the films, not for editorial.
Out of respect.
Just out of respect. Yeah.
Sure. So there's no
editing. Before the public.
Yeah. Makes sense.
Premiere.
So you're not.
You let them process it in their own way.
Yeah. Right, yeah. They have a head start on that.
So we showed Gay. We rented a cinema in New York, and we did the same thing with Gerald. But Gay, it was a chilly screening at the Tribeca Cinemas, the end of the screening, credits rolling, and then Gay, somewhat politely, but just clapped and was like, "Okay, it is what it is." And he said he supported it. He did say it was tough but fair, which for us was like the best thing we could have heard.
It's interesting, you have somebody who, now that I think about it, even though it's we've already said it's kind of more polite or respectful to maybe do a private screening for the subject, but in the context of an audience who's enjoying it, and you can tell, when you're in the theater, that could be even a better way, because he's now like, they like me. guys did a good job. Maybe there's something I don't know.
It's definitely, there is something, and for those of you who are in New York and are around for the IFC screenings, there is something to seeing it in an audience on a big screen.
Sure.
That, because there's a lot of, I mean, we make to a degree films that are somewhat comedic, but, you forget how funny, whatever, it isn't funny, but like I kept telling people, this isn't a comedic film. It's not a comedic film, and it's not. But there's a lot of laughing going on because there's uncomfortable laughter.
Yeah,
there's
sure.
Just a lot
and
of...
There's just some outrageous decisions that were made and played out over the years.
And it's a different experience
by Gerald and just going down to his looking through his house. He's just got, like everybody. We all probably have things that can make people laugh if you came to our homes.
Yeah.
Like you went into private areas of his house to snoop around for the sake of the documentary. I mean, in a sense, he opened the door to you. But so I'm sure in a lot of people's homes, you'd probably generate laughter if you went into all their with all their versions of what he's into, you know.
Yeah, and it's also it's nice to impossible. Well, it's also, I mean, Anita, Gerald's wife, really emerges in the second half of the film as well as a powerful character and a strong woman,
that
and
came
it's
out of
and that's something field. That like almost universally all audiences kind of respond to, and there's some comedy in there. She's like the voice of the audience in a weird way, you know.
Yeah, telling, and she was so quiet in the first half of the
movie. She really emerges, and it's great.
Okay, well, again, I'm going to remind everybody: Voyeur is Netflix. Being distributed by Netflix. Original documentary.
Netflix original.
So they came on. And it's but for, if you're in New York or Los Angeles, at what theater at the Los in the Lemley, do we know? I can find out.
I think it's Monica Film Center.
Monica Lemley Monica Film Center.
Okay.
That makes sense. I'll verify, confirm. And again in New York at the IFC Center starting Friday, December 1st, and then a same day if you're not in New York City.
Yes.
And you don't want to meet Josh and Miles and potentially Gerald. No,
Gerald.
No. Yeah. I know he's getting on. And but if you end up doing something close to Aurora, I bet he'll come out. Anyway, I'm not holding my breath. So he'll be walking around people's homes in the neighborhood who have Netflix and
looking through the windows.
Looking through their windows, exactly. Okay, thank
you, so
guys. Come back on next time. Okay, we'll do it again.
We'll see you in 5 years.
Okay.
Gerald Foose and I have a deal. That is, for me to tell the truth and him to live with it. Suddenly, this guy is forgetting what we've agreed to.
I think Gay and I are going to have a real problem.
What the hell does he think this is? Some kind of goddamn game?
They're trying to expose you as a hypocrite.
How do you know what they're thinking?
Because that's the way people are.
Did we hit a sore spot on you?
The story never ends. The story's never done. A lot of reporters think when they leave the story, it's all over. Sometimes it's just beginning.
Emily, played by Noelle Wells, is a talented but hard to classify comedic performer who left behind her home and her boyfriend to pursue career opportunities in Los Angeles when a loved one falls ill, a loved one named Mr. Roosevelt. Emily rushes back to Austin, Texas, where she's forced to stay with her ex-boyfriend and his new and improved girlfriend, a totally together woman with a 5-year plan. Though Emily is the same, everything else is different. Her house has been smartly redecorated. Her rocker boyfriend is training to be a real estate agent, and her old haunts show serious signs of gentrification. Okay, so this is a film called Mr. Roosevelt. It's opening, it's currently in screening in New York. It will be on Netflix as well, I believe, on December 26th. Check it out. Noelle Wells is the guest. You may recognize her from Master of None, The Incredible Jessica James, Saturday Night Live. She's lovely. She's funny. I did try to meet with her in person, but because of my gosh darn Kickstarter campaign, I had to change it and do it over the phone. I beg your pardon. I'm sorry, but this came out quite well. Here it is, my conversation with Noelle Wells, only on FilmWax Radio.
So we put him on fluids, and he perked up quite a bit. Then he took a turn for the worst. Worse. Worst. Which is it, turn for the worst? I never know.
Martin, shut up. You're like famous.
Emily's got over 20 million views on YouTube.
Oh my God. Honestly, it's too stupid to talk about.
You have really low self-esteem.
I moved from Austin about 2 years ago. This is my ex. I'm sorry. Is everything okay? Oh no. Hi, I'm here to see a patient, Mr. Roosevelt.
It's kidney failure.
Hello.
This is Celeste. It's my girlfriend.
Where are you staying?
The house looks amazing. Tea time. Why didn't you tell me about Celeste?
We haven't spoken since you broke up with me over the phone.
So, after you're staying with your ex-boyfriend, his new girlfriend. Emma.
Did I wake you? Yes. She is super, super nice.
Hello?
Hello?
Hello.
Hi.
Hi yourself. How are you?
I'm good.
Very good. Are they piling them on today with the interviews?
Yeah, we have a lot. We have a lot of stuff going on, but it's good.
Yeah, it is good. It's good. Great. Good for you. Good for the film.
Yeah. Yeah. My voice is a little scratchy. I wish it would stop being scratchy so that I don't know. It sounds weird.
Your voice?
Yeah.
Oh.
I just have this fog in my throat that won't go away.
Yeah, it sounds pretty good. I have no idea why it would be good. It's probably not very good for you, but anyway.
Maybe if we just keep saying it's good, I'll believe it.
Okay. Well, my name is Adam, anyway, and I do this podcast called Film Wax Radio. And this, you're Noelle Wells, correct?
Yes. Yeah.
Who is the director? You directed your first feature, Mr. Roosevelt, and you star in it. Very good casting choice. What drew you to casting Noelle Wells in the film?
I've been always writing characters for myself, and I've been shooting myself in my own projects since I was in high school. Because I'm good at characters, it made sense for it to be me.
You typecast. You're typecast already.
I'm typecasting myself
Yeah.
as the person that can do it.
It was very fun. Also, speaking of casting, I did notice, by the way, I'm a little offended because you did cast a very well-known podcaster, Doug Benson, in your class.
Oh, yeah, Doug Benson. I'm so sorry. I know he's your rival.
Yeah. Rival podcaster only. Not in other areas. In other areas, he definitely exceeds me in every, you know.
Yeah, I cast Doug. I wanted the movie to be filled with people, comedic people that I really like and admire, and also people that I haven't seen necessarily get to do the things that they got to do in my movie. And so it was really exciting that Doug agreed to play that part, even though it was smaller.
Sure, sure. This is your first feature, though. It's a lot more, I assume. A lot more on the line, of course, in terms of just the pressure, maybe, that it succeeds. I mean, I don't want to put that additional pressure on you, actually, Noelle. I just assume you might be feeling some of that because there's a big crew and there's a lot of people involved. So, and it sounds like you were very actively involved in the casting.
In the casting? Yeah. I think I was actively, as the director, I was actively involved with
every component,
involved with everything. All the casting decisions were mine, and I was not nervous about it. I just was excited to make it happen and have the resources to make it happen. It wasn't always easy with, giving direction to crew members I had never worked with before, and being sort of a boss, that part was a little shaky for me. But by the end, I was doing it just fine.
Mm-hmm. Maybe this is a corny question, but I'm curious specifically with you. I'm just wondering not sure the answer. After all that, it's going to sound like a stupid question now. Were there filmmakers that you looked to or inspired you at all?
I really like filmmakers that are good at evoking a particular feeling throughout a whole film. When I was a kid, my favorite directors were the Coen brothers. I think at like 10, I was saying Fargo was my favorite film, and
mine too.
I genuinely meant it. Yeah. But as I got a little older, some of the filmmakers that really resonate with me, and I watched some of their films over and over again, like Noah Baumbach, Mike Mills, really like Woody Allen's Husbands and Wives. And then there are movies that I really like that I think about all the time. And I was thinking about this film, I watched Swingers a bunch.
Oh, yeah.
because I really liked the sort of vibe of the film, not that I was trying to recreate any of it, but I just liked the tonality of it. I watched Rosemary's Baby.
Wow, those two back-to-back really work together as a double feature.
Yeah, they kind of do.
Oh, really?
Just being able to set like a whole atmosphere of tone to a film.
That's interesting. Very true. I mean, even though this is a comedy, Mr. Roosevelt, and it, you just reeled off quite a few of my favorite films and filmmakers, too. So I'm feeling very connected. Yeah. Feel very, very connected. Yeah, Fargo. It's fantastic. I had on the guy who plays his Marge's. Remember Marge, of course, who plays the. Yeah. You know, and
Frances McDormand.
Frances McDormand's character. So she's married. Remember, she's married to this salt of the earth guy who stays at home and makes her breakfast every morning. And he paints pictures of. What was he painting pictures of? Something very mundane. But it was
so like goose, geese, or like wasn't it like geese?
Something like that. He just would make. Yeah. Anyway, that actor just directed his first film, and he was on the podcast recently. So it was very exciting. Oh. It was really exciting for me to have him on. You know.
That's awesome.
But it's kind of exciting to have you on, too. And I should apologize. I was supposed to meet you in person yesterday.
Don't worry.
We were going to meet, and it's, you know, it's much better, ideally, to meet in person, of course, because, you know, you just sort of, you know, you create something special when you're in the room together. But this is fine. I just been doing this first-time Kickstarter, and I realized I had to, like, really focus on it. Speaking of which, have you had the opportunity to do a Kickstarter? Or any kind of fundraiser? Did you have to do one for Mr. Roosevelt?
I did not have to do one. The only time I've ever raised money were for a couple short films that I had shot, but fortunately I was only like raising like $500 to $700 at a time.
Oh yeah, slightly.
So it was more just like me dipping into my own, you know, into my own credit cards. Even though I did when I graduated college, I was $20,000 in credit card debt from filming my own project, and only recently was able to pay them all off. But that was cool.
Oh, I'm sure that was quite a relief, and allows
that's
you.
Yeah.
Mr. Roosevelt is a great name for the film. It refers to the cat that you shared with a former relationship and who passes away, and that's sort of the premise, right? So you go back. To, was it Austin? Okay. And Austin, Texas, where you guys had lived together. And now he's with this other woman. And it creates a kind of like a lot of tension because you still have some feeling, residual feelings for the man. Now, may I ask, were any of these things taken from real life at all? Or, I mean, of course.
The only part that was taken from real life is when I moved to LA, I did leave my cat with my ex-boyfriend.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And he did get really sick, and I did go back, but the story is completely different.
Sure.
First of all, he didn't die. I used all my savings to save him. He didn't have a new girlfriend. In fact, he was still very heartbroken, and it was the first time, I guess, in my life that I realized that I had responsibilities to other things and that I had neglected my responsibility to not only this pet that I really loved, but this man that I was really connected with, and that, you know, me breaking up with him really hurt him, and he didn't really communicate that to me. But I got to see it in person, and it was very harrowing sort of experience. I guess more sobering, really.
Mm-hmm.
But I was able to use all my savings to save my cat. Oh, am I losing you for a second? I'm going through a tunnel. Hold on.
Oh, you're in a car?
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah, sorry. We're heading to this next press thing.
Oh, where are you? What tunnel? I love tunnels.
Park Avenue, right under Park Avenue. But you can hear me, so we'll keep going.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I used all my savings to save my cat, and I did have a friend who got very upset about it and was like, it's just a fucking cat. Which is a line in the movie, but as you see, the movie plays out totally differently. I wanted to write a film that worked in and of itself, and in no way did I want it to be autobiographical.
It's interesting you brought up that you felt a responsibility to a boyfriend you broke up with. I mean, had he broken up with you, you wouldn't have had that responsibility.
Right.
So
yeah, totally.
So why is it really? Why are you responsible? Isn't he responsible for picking up his pieces and moving on and figuring it out?
Yeah, absolutely. I think though, in both of our immaturity, neither one of us really knew how to handle the situation. I don't think after spending 2.5 years with somebody, which I had with him, breaking up with him over the phone and then moving on with my life was really the most mature way of handling it, and then him not communicating to me about how that made him feel was also not very mature. So I think we both learned a lot in this situation. But but I care about him, and I cared about I care about my cat, and so seeing how I impact him, even, you know, I think the bigger thing is my cat has no responsibility to me. In fact, that was something that I was entrusted with, you know, his well-being was in my hands, and so I think that that's why it was the perfect perfect flashpoint for the film, because it really is about her guilt about, you know, sort of being irresponsible.
And then why did you decide to make the location Austin, Texas, other than the fact it may have helped a little premiere at South by Southwest, right?
Well, no, I went to college in Austin.
Oh, you went to University of Texas?
Yeah.
You too? Okay.
So I lived there for 5 years, and it felt like it was, I knew the location very well, and that was sort of, you know, a cheat for me to just be able to write the story.
Yeah, right. That's very true. You knew already, you already done years of location scouting, in a way. Yeah, makes sense. But were you able to tap into resources? Because, of course, there is a big film community, and there's the Austin Film Society, blah, blah, blah. I was wondering, were you able to tap into any of that, or was it completely an L.A. production?
No, we paired with a production company in Austin called Revelator.
Right. Oh, yeah, I did see that at the beginning of the film. Excuse me. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so they're very connected. They're tapped into those resources. Our crew was all Austin-based crew.
Oh, excellent.
We only had a couple crew from L.A., but everybody else was Austin-based.
Yeah.
So it was very much an Austin film.
My friend Jeffrey Marslett, who is a Austin-based filmmaker, also, I think he distributed through Revelator, he worked with them anyway. You know Jeff?
Jeff, right? Yeah, he was my animation professor.
Get out of here.
Yeah, he was.
Oh, yeah, he's a great
guy. There are boxes in the film that, you know, I opened in the shed, and those boxes Jeff had held on to from, he had them at his house, and so when we went to go shoot the movie, I got them. And used the contents from the box in the boxes, yeah.
Right. Oh, he's a friend of mine, and he did this podcast too. I just get a ton of people on here. I'm glad now to have you on. It feels great to bring you on. I'm a fan of your work, and so the premiere at South by, that seems like a natural then after shooting there and using local crew and your past there. So that went well.
Yeah, everything. Mm-hmm. We have the local crew, and then a lot of the cast was people that we cast out of Austin. You know, our main people were people that I had known from L.A.
Uh-huh.
and brought in to do the movie. But all the side characters was Austin talent.
Very good. And now the film is premiering theatrically. It's going to...
Yeah, it's currently playing in L.A. It's going to be in New York, and then we have other cities. There's Santa Fe, New Orleans.
Austin?
And I don't have them all in front of me either, but, you know...
Don't worry about that.
It's rolling out. It's still rolling out.
Yeah. No, I'll take care of all that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then it'll be on Netflix December 26th.
Oh, December 26th?
Yeah.
Oh, excellent. So we can kind of promote at the time. That'll be great.
Yeah.
You know. But what, is it not having a theatrical, or did it already in Austin?
It had its run in Austin already.
Yeah.
So it was an Alma job for about 2 weeks.
Oh, very good. Makes sense. Makes perfect sense. Maybe it's going to be here at the Draft House here. I don't know, in Brooklyn. I'm not sure. But I'll... Downtown. Okay.
So Wednesday, starting there.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm glad you knew that. Are you going to be there tomorrow?
I will be there.
Oh, very good. For the, like, a Q&A? Sounds good. Well, Noelle, it was delightful. And again, I wish I could have been there with you in person yesterday, but this was great too. And I wish you much success with the film and beyond.
Well, I hope you have a good day.
All right, you too. Thank you.
Okay, everybody. This is an intense documentary. It's really impressive. We first talk about that she came to this film because, of course, she was living and working in Baltimore for years on The Wire. She was living there because she was trying to commute from New York for a while, but it was just too crazy. So she moved her and her daughter to Baltimore. Her daughter went through high school. When the series ended, her daughter still had another year to go, so she stayed. Sonia stayed in Baltimore another year. And then they moved out, and then she came back again shortly afterwards to start this nonprofit, which she'll talk about. And then Kwame, who's here as well, has also become, he's a very young guy who has risen to become a big voice in Baltimore. Everyone, all citizens of Baltimore, deserve the same protections by the law. This shows how that breakdown has been going on in Baltimore in the wake of Freddie Gray's death. This documentary has now found its place onto HBO. You'll want to see it. It's a very powerful film. Again, this is Sonia Sohn, who is an actor and now director, and Kwame Rose, an artist, writer, musician, and public speaker. And they're both joining me here on FilmWax Radio. Thank you for listening, and we'll be back with an outro afterwards.
Freddie Gray, a young man arrested by Baltimore City Police last weekend, has died.
The Freddie Gray incident wasn't the cause of the uprising. It was just probably that last straw that broke the camel back. After decades of crying out,
what do we want? Justice! And when do we want it? Now!
History will one day look back and identify this year to define when American policing began to change.
I mean, something at that moment, like, snapped inside of me. It was just like, I can't just sit on the sideline. And that's what this is about.
I want you and Fox News to get out of Baltimore City because you're not here reporting about the boarded up homes. You're not reporting about the poverty levels, but you're here for the black riots.
I'm not an organizer. I wasn't a protester before any of this happened. I'm learning as I go.
Yeah, hello?
Yeah, I'm here. We're just waiting, I guess, for Sonia. Is that what's going on?
Okay.
Where are you?
Where am I?
Yeah, just curious where you are physically.
Oh, I'm in Baltimore.
Okay, at the moment. Are you? Okay, very good. Well, that good. That adds some texture to the conversation. That you're home in the city of what the documentary is all about, anyway, about what our conversation will be about. That's good. Hi, Sonia.
Hi. I'm outside. It might be a little distracting.
I understand.
But I'll do my best.
We'll all do our best. This is a podcast, so it's an audio experience, but, you know, so this will be a particularly interesting one, but I'm excited to talk about...
I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
That's okay. I actually hear you pretty well, and, you know, it's kind of exciting. We're minutes before the Thanksgiving holiday, and we're all trying to make this work. I would think I was going to come in the other day to HBO. It would have been a little bit easier for everybody, but this is fine. We can switch right into the film. I think, Kwame, you're still on the line?
Yeah.
Oh, great. Okay. Well, my name's Adam. The name of the podcast, just so you know, is called Film Wax Radio. And I basically try to champion and support lots of different independent films and documentaries and that kind of thing. So the name of the film is Baltimore Rising. Sonia, this is your first time making a feature film, let alone the documentary, correct?
That's right.
Mm-hmm. And normally I would just, you know, I mean, I guess everybody makes a first film, of course, once they decide they're going to make films, of course. But this is a heavy-duty film in so many ways. And the subject matter, obviously, it's very ambitious. And you pull it off remarkably well, I want to add. But did you not think... you're welcome. But were you so compelled that you felt like nobody else could make this film because of your relationship to... Baltimore, why start with such a, you know, seemingly challenging type of documentary?
Yeah, I don't want to compare. You know, I wasn't thinking no one else can make this film. You know, it was really much more organic and intuitive than that, you know. You know, I know the city. I lived there while I was working there. You know, my daughter went to high school there.
Okay.
I left, I came back, I was doing, you know, grassroots work there for, you know, several years when all this happened. And just, you know, I was in the right place at the right time. If there's such a thing, it was just, you know, I'm a storyteller in general. You know, that's what I do as an actor. You
know, I do have a writing background as well, but, you know, you have to understand stories to do what I do. But I also have a passion for the people in the city.
Yeah.
I had been completely taken by the city, by the city's, you know, most valuable, you know, treasure to me, and that's the people. When I came back to town to start the nonprofit and do the work, so much so that I, you know, for a while, I kind of almost disconnected myself from the entertainment, you know, my entertainment career in a really substantial way. But, you know, I got to a point where I realized, you know, one really did serve the other. I needed to kind of figure out how that worked in order to be impactful in one place and happy in the other. I was, you know, when this all, you know, happened and I was, you know, in town and people wanted to, I heard it, they wanted to reframe the narrative and whatnot. I just thought, I could be useful here. And that's, you know, how the song came about. I did not think I was going to direct it at first.
Oh, wow.
I thought that there are two directors who are executive producers. Mark Levin is a documentary director, and Anthony Hemingway is a narrative feature, you know, and a TV director. I thought one of them was going to direct this. I thought I was just going to, you know, introduce them to the people and produce, you know.
The tables were turned on you.
Excuse me?
I said the tables were turned, obviously.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. They were booked, and I was, you know, it's like, oh, shucks, you know, throw me the ring, I got it. we'll work it out.
That's great.
You know, somehow.
Yeah, again, a remarkable job, really. And so I want to bring Kwame out, of course. He's being very patient, waiting on the line there. And I just wanted to mention to people listening that, you know, the film takes place in the wake of Freddie Gray's death by six police officers. And, of course, that was the event also that would bring you guys together. Describe, Kwame, how you met Sonia and how you ended up being one of the primary subjects of the film.
well, I don't like to call myself a primary subject of the film, but I do think that...
Well, what do you prefer?
Sonia did was very... Well, you know, I think that we all play an important role, but the way that Sonia highlighted, you know, young people's voices, I think, is important for the next generation of leadership and change agents. So I met Sonia, I think we were on a walk. There was a walk in Baltimore City from Hilton and North Avenue to Milton and North Avenue, which is goes across the entire city of Baltimore. And then we just did some workshops where we, you know, told stories about people that were around Penn North, a little bit of our own experiences. And then, you know, as you look back 2 years and, oh, wow, we've been filming for 2 years, and the film is done. And so I think it's, you know, really great that, you know, people in Baltimore, because there was work being done before Freddie Gray passed. There was work being done after he passed. There was work being done after we stopped shooting.
Sure.
But I think it was like for a documentary and for a major company like HBO to tell a transparent story like this documentary came into fruition. I think that's important. Especially for people on the ground to be able to rewrite the narrative of the protests that were sensationalized by mainstream media.
Right. I'm just going to bring this in not as a tacky sort of thing. Most people may remember you, Kwame, very much from that crystallized moment where you had a confrontation with Geraldo Rivera on the streets during the protests, and which was being framed as rioting, and which I know is what was the most offensive thing to you, correct? The portrayal of just the rioting and then further stereotype what the people of Baltimore, how they behave.
Yeah, well, you know, even like calling the, you know, I find it, you know, when I want people to know that, you know, it wasn't a confrontation. It was my attempt to have a conversation in which we, like, you get to witness firsthand mainstream media not listening to people trying to express their pain.
Okay.
But yeah, this wasn't a riot. This was an uprising.
Mm-hmm.
This was provoked by the police. This was provoked by the lack of investment that had happened way before Freddie Gray passed. And what it did was invoke a lot of trauma and pain that many people face, because it could have been any one of us in the city of Baltimore that day, because many of us have had our own challenges with the police.
Sure.
And, you know, it was, we were on the ground. We were as peaceful as peace could be. We weren't singing Kumbaya, but rather we were singing
why is this happening, and this is what the conditions that caused this to happen. Mm. So I think that's what the difference between a riot. A riot is kind of random. Now, this was like sprung out of like years of lack of investment, years of police brutality, years of lead paint poisoning being tested on kids in Baltimore City.
Mm-hmm. Asthma, whatever comes along with neglected housing, et cetera. Correct. Sonia, you mentioned before you lived in Baltimore all the years that you were shooting the, some other HBO production I'm not familiar with. I'm kidding. But you were living there that entire time, correct? Did you say you raised your daughter there and she was going to school there?
What was the last part?
Oh, I'm sorry. You raised a child in Baltimore. Is that during those years or subsequently? What were you saying?
Well, she attended high school there.
Okay. Was that because you were
shooting
The Wire?
The first year I was living in New York, and it was such a hectic schedule that I ended up relocating to Baltimore. So I spent the next 6 years in Baltimore. I think it was 2002 to 2008.
Yeah. Was that when the series ended, when The Wire ended, and you stayed on a little longer because she was in high school?
No, that was during the course of shooting. The Wire ended in 2007. But my daughter was a senior in high school.
Sure.
So I let her, I stayed for the next year.
Of course.
And then I came back, actually. I came back in 2009.
In 2009?
I left in August. I was back in, April.
It was in your blood. It just got in your blood. The city?
Yes, among other things.
Well, you mentioned you also started a nonprofit. Can you just mention that again, or what the nonprofit is about?
Yeah, back when I came to town, with the nonprofit, and we were doing more. We came to town at first with the Rewired for Life, which was a pilot program that used the Wire as a teaching tool for formerly incarcerated youth. It was like a life skills program. But also a critical thinking program where the young people were putting themselves into the positions of the young people in the Wire, which would make it relate. And they also, were able to express themselves through poetry and journaling. It was really successful and a lot of fun, to be honest with you. And we made some long-standing connections. But from there, we were doing some direct service and some community building work, realizing that if you're going to support young people, you've got to support the community around them. You can't just, have them come into a program, they're going to go home, to the neighborhood. And that is their safety net. And that needs to be, cultivated and nurtured as well. So then we've sort of branched out into some community building work. We had, executed some great initiative called the Baltimore Wake Up. We funded, a lot of... microfunded a lot of community groups to do programs in their own neighborhoods, which was successful. And then, really understanding that media advocacy is really our unique offering, realizing that there's so many folks who are doing so much of some similar work that we were offering in terms of direct service. We're now, moving more towards, using the sort of media advocacy part of our mission, especially, as we move forward from here, and raising funding for grassroots nonprofits, which, historically don't get the funding because of, various protocols and regulations. So I think as, being on the ground for so long, and this is why long-term commitment, in my opinion, is really important. I came down like every bleeding heart, that wants to serve, and I had an idea, which is still viable and still, operable and all that, but the longer you stay, the more, entrenched you become, engaged you become, the more you get to know the people, the more you're able to determine and understand what is needed and what hole you can fill.
Of course.
And when you get there, that's when you can be truly, truly impactful.
Mm-hmm.
When you fit that square peg in the square hole, and there was a hole there, and it was waiting for you to fill. And, so we want to change. I'm very excited for the future of Baltimore. I think right now we're at a really, we're at a tipping point.
for the long haul. And I think that's what people need. Some people
that's what the city needs, yeah.
That wasn't a moment. Mm-hmm. That's showing you the internal workings to change. That's like a slide, you know, like a microscope slide, you know.
Uh-huh.
That's all that is, you know. It's just a sliver of what we do.
I got it. I understand. Hey, Kwame, I know it's the events that took place during the film and not necessarily the film itself that probably has really changed your life. But before you might have called yourself maybe an artist and as a musician, I wonder as well as an activist, what do you identify yourself as now since life has obviously changed so much in the last bunch of years?
You know, I always say I was active way before I was ever called an activist.
Mm-hmm.
And now I've embraced the role. You know, I've had the ability to, you know, because of a platform, for me just challenging mainstream media, I've had the ability to write for mainstream media or write for media publications, mm-hmm. Huffington Post, USA Today, and Mashable, and offer a different perspective. But you know, I've also stayed on the ground and done work with youth. I've had a nonprofit since 2013 called Brothers in Action Incorporated. So continuing to work, I mean, you know, the issues were highlighted, but the challenges still remain in everyday life in Baltimore. And, you know, it's just about, you know, I look at it for me is that I'm young, I'm still young, and that the decisions I made at 21, the mistakes and the, mm-hmm. the success, you know, they shaped me into the person and who I am today at 23. And I think that's important to understand is that, you know, we didn't know what we were doing. We just knew we had to do something. And, you know, we're learning as we go. But I think that's the important part. As long as we learn and grow in leadership and continue to pour efforts into Baltimore and resources, I think one day Baltimore will say that, you know, we have tackled the problem with the high murder rate. We've tackled the problem with the high heroin addiction.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I hope that by the time I become old and one of the, one of the elders in Baltimore, that I can say that, you know, my work, my efforts, along with many others, help shape the next generation of Baltimore change agents.
I wouldn't be surprised if that's the case, actually, given what I see. The film is called Baltimore Rising. It's currently available for streaming and viewing on HBO and all of its other platforms, directed by Sonia Stone, and including of many subjects involved in the film, Kwame Rose. Listen, I just really appreciate your guys coming on. I hope you have a great Thanksgiving. And, thank you very much for making this happen today.
Thank you so much. Have a great Thanksgiving.
All right, Sonia. Bye-bye. Bye, Kwame. Nice meeting you both.
All right, take care.
This movement has taken on so much more meaning for me.
Give me the law that I'm breaking.
Wait a minute. Come here, man.
Are you still representing Kwame? He just got arrested. I wish I was kidding.
My interest on behalf of the city right now is surviving this moment. We can't get through this without you guys.
There's been a great awakening. It almost took this uprising to wake us up.
Despite her success in creating Facade of Safety for us.
Facade of Safety, really?
You had a very, very good count.
Mom, oh my God.
You got a whole lot of living to do. Don't ruin your future with that bullshit. I want you to be smart, not just for Baltimore, but for Kwame.
It's not about what you do with your life, but it's about the legacy that you leave. Freddie Gray sparked a movement, an uprising inside of our minds. And the most powerful thing that we can do is keep fighting for that.
Thanks, everybody. Once again, do check out our Kickstarter campaign. Go to Kickstarter and put Film Wax Radio in the search bar, and it'll come up. And please be generous and do whatever you can do. Any amount, small or otherwise, is appreciated. And we'll just all go through the next phase of this podcast and Film Wax together. Okay, so I think on the next episode we've got a bunch of things coming up, including Eric Schaefer, who many people may know from his offbeat comedies or from over the years. We have an episode coming up with Giancarlo Esposito. We have an episode coming up. We have Henry Jacqueline back for a full, I think, hour. Sam Pollard back for his third visit, the documentary filmmaker. We've got Gold Brothers, Ari, and Ethan Gold with a new film. We've got Zephyr Thrall. We have the film illustrator, the guy who made all these movie posters. He's an incredible artist. His name is Tony Stella. He's living in Berlin, I believe, and we did an episode together. One of the pioneers of indie film, Seymour Wishman, who started, he was one of the early pioneers of independent film, and he has been running first-run features for decades. He's coming on. Cinematographer Sam Levy, who shot the new Greta Gerwig film. Also, finally, friends of the podcast, Jason Cortland and Julia Halperin, who had been on a while ago with the film called Now Forager, are back with their newest film. It's called Barracuda. And so much more. So much more. Thank you for listening, everybody. This has been Film Wax Radio. I'm your host, Adam Shartoff. I appreciate your time. I appreciate your listening. I appreciate your support of Film Wax. Thank you. Please take care of yourself and the ones you love. Until next time, take care. Broken lives, broken strings, broken threads, broken springs, broken idols, broken heads, people sleeping in broken beds. Ain't no use jiving, ain't no use joking, everything's broken. Broken bottles, broken plates, broken switches. Choking.